This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate. We think too much and feel too little. We need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness. Without these qualities, life will be violent. No, will be lost. Do not despair. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die. Dictators die. And the power they took from the people will return to the people. Will return to the people. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. To do away with greed. Now let us fight.
Hello! Yoo-hoo! Okay, welcome. It is Friday, September 25th, 2015. This is Deanna Spingola, and I am subbing for Clint Richardson on the Corporation Nation here on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. Clint's websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. Clint has produced the following videos: The Corporation Nation, Lethal Injection, The Story of Vaccination, Kaffir School, School Districts, and the Lottery, and Common Core, Agenda 21, and Global Privatization. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. We will have two chat rooms open tonight, corporationnation.chatango.com and spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour at 800-313-9443. Many RBN listeners have heard of John Verrappen and his book, Side Effects Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. Paperback, you can get it right now at Amazon for $161.55 for a new copy. Or you can buy an old used one for $88.87. However, you can also purchase one copy from American Free Press, and I think it's only $25 for a new copy. Anyway, John Verrappen worked for the pharmaceutical industry beginning in about 1968. He started out as a salesman who knocked on doctors' doors. He worked his way up and eventually worked as the general manager of Eli Lilly and Company. He was located in Sweden, and he worked for Eli Lilly for 35 years. Now, according to the American Free Press, and they did interview him sometime back, I really don't know what his status is now. I know that the last time that I emailed with him, he had a health issue. So I'm not sure what's going on with him now. But anyway, the American Free Press says, Verrappen helped to gain approval for infamous drugs like Prozac, sweet-talking doctors and their staff to accept his free samples of the latest concoction from his company, bribing opinion leaders and regulatory authority employees, all to get more drugs into the hands of patients, some drugs that came with deadly side effects. After the birth of his last child over 10 years ago, the hackles on the back of his neck were raised when he saw who Big Pharma was marketing to now. Kids. Yes, kids. John decided right there and then to get the message out to as many as possible to warn them about the pills he had been pushing, to educate them about the deadly side effects he knew existed, but that Big Pharma knew how to hide from public view. Pharmaceutical companies want to keep people really sick. They want to make others think that they are sick. And they do this for one reason only. Money. Sometimes you select to do things simply because you want to do them. But often people will do anything in the world for money. Did you know that pharmaceutical companies, and this was, it might still be going on, that pharmaceutical companies invest over $50,000 per physician each year to get them to prescribe their products. More than 75% of leading scientists in the field of medicine are paid for, quote unquote, by the pharmaceutical industry. Also, corruption prevailed in the approval and marketing of drugs in some cases. Yes, corruption did prevail, and it still does. Illnesses are made up by the pharmaceutical industry and specifically marketed to enhance sales and market shares for the companies in question. Pharmaceutical companies increasingly target children. Okay, as I mentioned, one may purchase his book from American Free Press for $25. Now, there have been numerous whistleblowers from the medical industrial complex, or what I refer to as the Political Pharmaceutical Alliance, or the Psycho-Pharmaceutical Government Media Complex. I have interviewed some of them. One of the best whistleblowers, Dr. Jennifer Daniels, has a program on RBN on Sunday night. She's fabulous. If you have not heard her program, please listen to it. You will learn so much from her. And she's just terrific. Just one of the best whistleblowers we have currently. And I just applaud her tremendously for all that she has done for so many people and for the things that she's doing right now on RBN for the RBN listeners. Anyway, I interviewed a former pharmaceutical rep yesterday on Blog Talk. But back to John Verrappen. He wrote, "Imagine if you could talk those who aren't ill into taking pills. Then you would reach a new dimension of marketing. That is the new quality of a blockbuster." And that was exactly the role of fluoxetine was supposed to play. But it happened more by chance, since it wasn't actually suited to this role. Fluoxetine is a new active ingredient from, or was a new active ingredient from Eli Lilly's laboratory. For some time, they had been doing research for an antidepressant and had found an active ingredient which influenced serotonin levels. Now, keep in mind that also, and you can tell by the name, that this substance also has fluoride in it, as do many other pharmaceutical drugs. Anyway, serotonin, as I mentioned, that this new active ingredient was supposed to influence serotonin levels. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter in the brain. Starting in the 1960s, research had been carried out on these substances to find out what role they played in sensory perception or in emotional perception. One consideration was to suppose that there was a certain balance of serotonin levels, which was good. Imbalance, on the other hand, would lead to depression, to hyperactivity, and much more. This consideration is known as the serotonin theory. Theory. Not science. Theory. The serotonin theory, Eli Lilly's new active ingredient, fluoxetine, belongs to the so-called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Thus, an active ingredient which prevents the reuptake of the neurotransmitter serotonin in the brain, which turns the regulating switch of the serotonin balance and supposedly restores the balanced ideal state. But we were in the mid-1980s, and at that time, only those receiving clinical treatment took psychotropic drugs. Nevertheless, while studying fluoxetine, an interesting side effect occurred, which the company bosses deemed to be much more lucrative. Some of the test subjects had lost weight while taking the new active ingredient. Okay, I'm going to share some information from John's book, John Verapin. And as I said, you can purchase it either at Amazon or at American Free Press. The price is much better at American Free Press, only $25. Okay, now John was he was a general manager in Sweden, and he had a lot. Well, let me tell you what he says. He says, "My fluoxetine doctors were eating out of the palm of my hand. We had only just returned to Sweden when I generously began to hand out the new pills. Time for the sewing. My doctor saw to it that as many of their patients as possible enjoyed them. This is how our new drug was launched before it had even been approved." And you might say the same thing for just about any other drug. For instance, Gardasil. And this is not from John's book, but Gardasil was marketed long before it was ever approved by the FDA, and long before it went to market. They were doing the marketing, and marketing is a big feature in producing and promoting a drug. They do all the marketing beforehand. They hand out all these trial samples, and they do all of this marketing beforehand for all drugs. Okay, back to Verapin's book. Fluoxetine was now being used in many clinics, but we weren't so much interested in the sick. And in parentheses, he says, "If we suppose that people who visit a hospital for psychic problems or those who are referred there by force are ill." Now, the blockbuster is characterized by the fact that it blurs the boundary between sick and healthy, that it is used uniformly because only then can it achieve its extraordinary sales record. And that is what pharmaceutical companies are interested in, is in the sales records. They want to sell as many of these pills as they possibly can. Now, back to the book. Unfortunately, as far as the approval in Sweden was concerned, nothing had made a difference. The situation grew more acute. Sidney Tarrell, now the CEO of Eli Lilly and Company, was then vice president of the European sector. A big shot. Now, let me give you some additional information on Tarrell, and it's spelled T-A-U-R-E-L. The Bush family and Eli Lilly had numerous connections. George W. Bush, as president, appointed Lilly CEO Sidney Tarrell as a Homeland Security Advisory Council member. And Tarrell is also the past president of the pharma, of which all major drug companies are members. And pharma is spelled PHRMA. It's a big organization, so all the drug companies are members. Okay, so he was now the president, the vice president in charge of the European sector. He was a big shot, Verapin says, "I had been at a company internal seminar in London, and Sidney Tarrell appeared briefly to tell us how important motivation was." Okay, moving forward, when Tarrell found out that Verapin was going to get a flight back to Sweden that very same day. Tarl offered to take him to the airport, and of course, Verapin willingly agreed. And he says, and there we were sitting in his car. It was a large car, at the front of the car, upright, as if he were standing up, while sitting down was the driver, a man who would have looked great on a large stage as a speaker, maybe. He hadn't said much. He had greeted Sidney Tarl and then me and had opened the doors for us, held them open, and after we had slid across the back seat, he had gently closed the doors so you could scarcely hear the lock. The car left the hotel, which resembled a park in a suburb of London, and made its way to the airport. Tarl did everything to make Verapin feel small. He knew the coolie head only too well. The hearty invitation in the hotel resulted in a journey in which Tarl didn't even speak to Verapin. Knowing that, appropriate to their respective status, it was up to Tarl to start the conversation. And instead, Tarl just thumbed through his notes. And Verapin says, the sound of his papers was the only conversation. The leather on which I was sitting didn't get warm. I wondered whether Tarl maybe had seat heating and whether the driver already knew simply from the manner in which Tarl and I had approached the car that the heating for my seat shouldn't be switched on. Suddenly, the bustle of the airport, planes starting and landing, service trucks and passenger buses were all in view. And Sidney Tarl finally broke his silence. Prozac, he began. Verapin says, I nodded and waited for him to continue. That subject, said Tarl, is very important to me. He added, just as the car began to slow down and pull into a parking space. Verapin didn't answer and wasn't expected to. He understood the message. The approval had to progress in Sweden. And Tarl said, do you understand? And Verapin stood on the tarmac about to shut the door, and as obedient as a schoolboy, he said, yes, sir. But Sidney Tarl had already returned to his notes, and the driver had already removed my luggage from the trunk. He gave it to Verapin, shut the car door, and showed Verapin the direction to the tarmac. The message was clear. Verapin's career depended upon the rapid approval of fluoxetine in Sweden. Sidney Tarl would then be able to market it as Prozac in the United States. So Verapin, he had this problem. He was the general manager in Sweden. So he had a decision to make. His entire career was based on how he was going to get Prozac or fluoxetine approved in Sweden. So, let's see what he says. Verapin writes, I was forced to take a closer look at the problem. It didn't take long to find out that the Swedish regulatory authority wasn't even planning to approve fluoxetine. One of the members of the medical review board was a top-notch psychiatrist who had been doing research on the active ingredient. However, she was only using 5 milligram doses, which she thought to be the absolute maximum in view of the risks associated with fluoxetine. She was not at all convinced of its benefit. Eli Lilly, on the other hand, had applied for the approval of 20 milligram doses. The signals I was receiving from the regulatory authority didn't look good. Where should I start? In the meantime, my boss, Sidney Tarl, had arrived again and had formulated his request to push fluoxetine somewhat more clearly. In other words, do it or else. What he actually said was, and I quote, "Think about your career." And Verrappin says, well, that was clear enough. And I wasn't the only one. More than a decade later, in 1999, internal documents from that era at the English Lilly office were published, which support the tone of the bosses and the pressure in these other offices. Whatever happens in Great Britain, according to one of the memos, and I quote, whatever happens in Great Britain can jeopardize the drug Prozac in the United States and the rest of the world, end quote. This was an internal memo from Lee Thompson, one of Lilly's most important scientists. He was referring to the publication of the drug's side effects in England, such as suicide. And he wrote the following concerning a member of the American Regulatory Authority, the FDA, who had suggested comparing the suicide risk of Prozac with those of other antidepressants, which didn't suit Lilly at all because Prozac came off poorly in comparison. He is quite clearly a political creature. And he will have to react to pressure. In other words, whoever was going to approve it in Sweden would have to react to pressure. And Verrappin wrote, pressure? An employee of the regulatory authority should have to react to pressure from the pharmaceutical industry? What sort of pressure would a company be able to exercise on an authority? You can see how tough and self-assured these people are. Let me just check in the chat rooms and see what's going on. Let me just say hi to people. As I mentioned before, we have two chat rooms open tonight. We have corporationnation.chatango.com, and we also have spingola.chatango.com, and we have people in both rooms. Alrighty, okay. So back to John Verrappin and his terrific book, which is entitled "Side Effects: Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider." It's a fabulous book. I have a Kindle version, and it's just a fabulous book. Anyway. Verrappin is referring to an employee of Lilly, Eli Lilly, in England, and he says that he hopes realizes that Lilly is down the drain if we lose Prozac. One single event in England could cost us that. And then he says, I had to think of something urgently. And sure enough, when I was half asleep one evening, I had a vision. I had found the point where I could change things. And I suspect that John Verrappin was the general manager in Sweden just because he was, well, kind of a visionary. And he refers to himself as something else as we move along here through his text. Anyway, he said, the clinical studies which we would submit to the regulatory authorities were, first of all, evaluated by an independent expert. His evaluation was important since he was paid for the Herculean work of scrutinizing the columns of figures one by one. He did the preliminary work for the regulatory authority. And as a matter of procedure, his identity was naturally unknown to the pharmaceutical companies submitting the applications. And Verrappin says, what if I was able to find out who the individual was, who would read and evaluate the fluoxetine protocols? If we knew who he was, we could create a profile for him. In other words, they were going to profile him. and figure out how they could get to him, how they could buy him, how they could influence him. Back to Verapin. We could find out about his affections and desires. We could find out how high the threshold was, which we had to cross to cut a deal with him. That was intimate territory. Learned and well practiced, I started on the detective work. And when you read the rest of the book, before we're actually on page 89 in a book that has 207 pages. But John Verapin, he was quite sly. He was he had a lot of influence. He bought a lot of influence. He knew how to work people very, very well. Okay, back to his book. At first, I found out that based on their qualification and position, only one of five doctors in the whole country of Sweden could be the independent expert. One of five. It didn't seem that impossible to find out who it was. I created profiles for each of these five. One of them belonged to the health authority, so it couldn't be him. Only four remained. I had my employees gather information. I asked the representatives, and those are the drug detailers, the representatives who visit the doctors. I asked the representatives responsible for the respective regions to make hidden but well-directed inquiries, to ask their secretaries indirect questions, which would provide us with conclusions without them recognizing the intentions behind the questioning, without feeling compromised. And I pieced the mosaic together carefully. One after another, they disappeared from the picture until only one remained. It was our Mr. Unknown, a man from the west coast of Sweden. Verapin continues, I began to study Mr. Unknown a bit more carefully. He liked sailing. I bought myself a book about sailing. I found out what type of yacht he had. I had information brought to my office. I studied these texts. I looked at the pictures of the yacht. He did a lot of imagining, just figuring out exactly how he was going to approach Mr. Unknown. Verapin continues, I wasn't really nervous. Well, it wasn't that I wasn't at all nervous. Of course you are nervous. It's like appearing on stage. It is the previous knowledge, the fact that you have something in mind that produces the nervousness. I have learned to concentrate on the things which really matter in these situations, the things I want to achieve. The trick is not to go like a bull at a gate, but nevertheless to get a foot in the door. You have to appear to act normally. An actor once told me the most difficult part of his profession was not the adjustment, not the evident role play, but the ability to remain completely normal while being watched. Okay, we're going to cut to a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. There's a battle ahead. Many battles are lost, but you never see the end of the road. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and I am subbing for Clint tonight, and I'm very happy to have this opportunity. Anyway, I was sharing with you some things from John Verapin's book, which is entitled Side Effects Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. And he was trying to figure out how he was going to approach this Mr. Unknown. And he said that an actor once told me, and I'm reading from his book on page 90, an actor once told me that the most difficult part of his profession was not the adjustment, not the evident role play, but the ability to remain completely normal while being watched. That certainly applied to me in that meeting with Mr. Unknown. And this paragraph is really really very significant. One factor helped me in this plan. I didn't really like Mr. Unknown. Real sympathy made business contacts more difficult, at least in the field I worked in. You don't like to trick someone that you know. To lie to someone you like is difficult. To lie at all should be difficult. This is amazing. And he goes on, you don't want to make someone overstep the boundary of legality if you like them. The fact that I didn't like him helped a lot. He was an a-hole, I'm not going to say the word, and I was one too. So we fitted like a glove. In other words, they were both corrupt. They were both, they were both scoundrels. And I go on, John goes on. We spent a nice evening together. I told him openly who I worked for. We talked about this and that. I even showed him some protocols from our registration documents. Mr. Unknown laughed his Swedish, whatever a Swedish psychiatrist laugh is, but apparently there is one. But anyway, no, Mr. Unknown didn't like fluoxetine. He didn't think anything of it at all. Not impressed. The evening came to an end. As previously said, you don't like a bull at a gate. You don't go like a bull at a gate, but you have to get your feet over the threshold. I paid for both of us, and my decision had been made. I soon phoned him again. And Mr. Verappin goes on. An evening meal is always good, he said. Apparently he'd phoned him and asked him out for an evening meal again. And Verappin says, this time I would let the cat out of the bag. I didn't know if it would be during or after the main meal. I had steered the conversation back to the topic of fluoxetine. After all, Mr. Unknown knew that we, Eli Lilly, wanted to get approval for it in Sweden. I agreed. And he said, John told Mr. Unknown, don't take it the wrong way, but I know that you are in charge of our case at the health board. And Mr. Brappin goes on. Mr. Unknown didn't take offense. He just grinned, aware of his importance, and ordered another glass of wine at Eli Lilly's expense. And Brappin told him, 7 years are a long time. I would have put, is a long time. Brappin said casually. Mr. Unknown nodded over the edge of his wine glass and carried on grinning. Brappin changed the subject for a while and spoke about sailing. Mr. Unknown didn't appear reluctant to the change of course. He invited Brappin to his yacht, and Brappin asked him what he would need to shorten the 7 years a little, if it was possible to sail close to the wind? And Mr. Unknown responded, the experienced yachtsman circumnavigates even the roughest coastline. And Rappin said, but to sail around, that would be impossible, even for an experienced yachtsman. Rappin continued, testing the ground. A dried-up ocean is completely unsuitable for yachts. Mr. Unknown didn't want to contradict me, Brappin said. Not as far as sailing was concerned, but maybe in different areas there might be ways out of that type of desert. Brappin said, and I quote, what would be needed then? And Mr. Unknown set down his wine glass, wiped his mouth with his serviette, and spoke quietly. And I quote, money is always useful, unquote. After giving it some thought, he named an amount. Verappin paid for dinner, and they left the restaurant and arranged to meet the next week. Well, Verappin was very happy. In fact, he was It was raining outside, and his umbrella was in the car. He didn't care. He just felt light. He just knew that things were going to go his way. He said, "I was happy. I knew that the company would fork out the money. The office in Copenhagen was responsible for the whole of the northern region." The next day, I called the director in Copenhagen and let him know that the cost would be 100,000 crowns to get a speedy approval in Sweden. Back then, that would be about $20,000. I told him who the check was payable to and that it would be cashed in Copenhagen, Denmark for tax purposes. Mr. Unknown didn't want his discretionary earnings to be cut by the tax man. The director could understand that. The transfer wasn't to go through our books, but would be processed by the office in Geneva. It would probably be booked as a research grant, quote, unquote. And as I was reading this earlier, when you look at all the research grants that are given out by the pharmaceutical companies to various individuals and to various institutions, you kind of wonder, well, was it really research grants? Were they really all grants to do research? Or was it, well, was it a bribe? And I think that, well, who knows? Anyway, Rappin writes, "My director in Copenhagen told me he would have to discuss it with his financial manager. The office in Copenhagen consulted Lilly's office in Geneva. In Geneva, lots of, or even most of, Eli Lilly's transactions are bundled. It took one day. Then I received a call from my director in Copenhagen, and that director said, and I quote, 'John, do whatever you think is necessary. We won't put any obstacles in your way,' unquote." Okay. So at least, as John said, Mr. Rappin goes on, at least I could tell Mr. Unknown at the next meeting that everything had been arranged. That pleased him. And Mr. Unknown had thought up a little surprise for me. The arranged sum of $20,000 had probably been a test to fathom out how much leeway there was, because he additionally demanded that he and his colleagues receive a research assignment from Lilly for fluoxetine. This stuff that he had snootily shaken his head about would earn him and his colleagues a lot of money for years to come. A whole department could live off this one contract alone. What was going on in this guy's head? Did he now seriously want to personally prescribe fluoxetine, the very ingredient that he had banished to the realms of nonsense just 2 weeks ago with his Swedish psychiatrist laugh? He certainly wasn't thinking of his patients. He was probably thinking like we were. He was behaving like we were. He was taking what he could get. The company didn't care, since they would have to give the contract to someone else or some clinic anyway. Every Western country stipulates that post-marketing studies are carried out on the approved drug in that country. With Mr. Unknown, we could be sure that the results would turn out positively for us. And, if not, he had already shown willingness to change his opinion for the correct sum of money. He was an incredibly valuable contact indeed. Mr. Unknown received the check for the first half of the money immediately. The second half was to follow when the approval had been successful. One of my colleagues was responsible for organizing these study results and preparing them for registration approval. Now, these studies Protocol 27 in particular, which I will come back to later, didn't turn out to be particularly positive. In fact, Protocol 27 is very popular. If you Googled Prozac and comma Protocol 27, you would find out a lot about this. Anyway, back to the book. So we weren't able to gleam with the success of our substance. That stuff had revealed more side effects than any kind of benefit. Anyway, Mr. Unknown did everything he could to help us out of this dilemma. He requested that I send him my colleague to prepare the existing data in such a way that the regulatory authority wouldn't need to ask any awkward questions. We reserved a hotel room for the meeting. Neutral ground, so to speak. Together, we made sure that the assessment commission wouldn't stumble over unwelcome details. The enormous pile of files were newly arranged and shuffled like the cards in a game of poker. Statistics, playing with figures, deaths appeared in footnotes. You can imagine it like this. For example, instead of, and I quote, from 10 people who took the active ingredient XYZ, 5 had hallucinations and tried to commit suicide, which 4 of the test subjects succeeded in doing. Then it says, with one of the test subjects, everything went by plan. Weight loss was recorded in 4 of the test subjects, and 5 of the other test subjects had miscellaneous effects. And already, that awful word, suicide, is no longer to be found. I don't know how they did it exactly, and I really didn't care. The only thing that interested me was that approval, that approval would evidently be given very quickly. Mr. Unknown utilized all of this knowledge and expertise for our purposes. On top, he placed his own personal letter of recommendation. The state had paid for the independent and unbiased evaluation contained in that very paper. Where the state expected that the well-being of the patients had been the highest priority, such papers are sometimes the only protection there is for people in their respective countries against the arbitrariness of the pharmaceutical industry and the side effects of new products. This was all trampled on. Now, isn't that something? And that is the way that Prozac gained approval in Sweden. And thereafter, it also gained approval in Great Britain, or Britain. And then it gained approval in the United States. Alrighty. As I mentioned, I just shared information with you from Side Effects Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. And that it was written by John Verrappen. And let me just give you the, his name is spelled V-I-R-A-P-E-N. Again, Side Effects Death, Confessions of a Pharma Insider. It's available at Amazon or from American Free Press for $25. I think that I mentioned earlier that it was over $100 to purchase it at Amazon for a paperback, brand new. So that's amazing. Alrighty, let me check in the chat rooms and see if there's any questions. Okay, let's see. Okay, let's see. What, already? Yes, it's certainly a depopulation plan. Indeed. Okay, now I'm going to share some information. Continuing on the subject of Prozac, I'm going to share some information from my book, and the title of the chapter is Prozac, a blockbuster of a killer. And subtitle, SSRIs, Engineered Psychoses. Now, the origin of SSRIs was in the 1960s when Paul Kielholz, K-I-E-L-H-O-L-Z, became a professor of psychiatry in Basel, the location of the major Swiss chemical companies. Thus, he was well positioned to become a leading figure in the psychopharmacology world. Fluoxetine, known under the trade names of Prozac, Seraphim, Lados, and Fontex, among others. There are 175 different names for what people in America know as Prozac. It was created in 1974. It is an antidepressant of a class of drugs called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs. It was one of the first therapies in its class used to treat what people called clinical depression. It theoretically blocks the uptake of serotonin within the human brain. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back.
Derivatives, quantitative easing, trade imbalances, recession, low GDP, nations close to collapsing, and subprime loans, foreclosed homes, and people's taxes spent to bail out too big to fail, AAA banks again. Fear levels rising as the US crash seems imminent, having smashed the debt ceiling of $14 trillion despite protests and clashes in Athens streets. The IMF imposed structurally unjust programs in Greece, where in fact the term economy entered our language from the Greek oikonomia, meaning household management. Well, how are we managing? Theories abound, but in practice, does anyone actually know what the hell's even happening? Well, seems we've come to our global auditing, our financial day of reckoning. It's an interesting quandary. Have we invested too much in this enterprise?
Alrighty, we are back. I'm sharing some information from my chapter, a chapter in my book called Prozac, a Blockbuster of a Killer. And I am subbing for Clint tonight, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. If you have any questions or comments, you may email comment@spingola.com, or you can call in the next hour. Alrighty, as I said before, that Prozac, which, and there are 175 different names for Prozac throughout the world, it was one of the first therapies in its class used to treat people to treat what people call clinical depression. And it theoretically blocks the uptake of serotonin within the human brain. Now, by 2010, doctors would prescribe it to more than 54 million people worldwide. A blockbuster is a pill with an enormously high sales quota, one that might be sold a billion times and represent a gigantic sales volume. It might temporarily relieve the symptoms, but that is secondary, as many people feel ill, and there are many illnesses. In fact, when people first start taking a medication, they have high hope, and so they automatically think that, well, it does make you feel better, but then other things occur. That feeling does not, it's a temporary feeling. Nevertheless, illness is the exception and not the rule. Consequently, sick people represent a relatively small market. John Verrappen wrote, and I quote, "Imagine if you could talk those who aren't ill into taking pills. Then you would reach a new dimension of marketing. That is the new quality of a blockbuster." That was exactly the role fluoxetine was supposed to play. Eli Lilly, a pharmaceutical company based in Indianapolis, also has offices in Puerto Rico and 17 other countries. It sells its products in approximately 125 countries. It was the first company to mass produce penicillin, the Salk polio vaccine, and insulin, including human insulin using recombinant DNA. Lilly is the world's largest manufacturer and distributor of psychiatric medications, including Cialis, Cymbalta, Gemzar, methadone, and Prozac. By 1984, Eli Lilly was well aware of the serious issues with Prozac, long before Lilly introduced it to the American market. Statistics? Okay. I think we're going to a break. Are we going to a break? Okay. The honor of subbing for Clint Richardson tonight, and his websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. Clint has produced the following videos: The Corporation Nation, Lethal Injection, The Story of Vaccination, Kaffir School, School Districts, and The Lottery, and Common Core, Agenda 21, and Global Privatization. During the program, email your questions or comments to comment@spingola.com. Please visit one or the other of the chat rooms, or even both, corporationnation.chatango.com and spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in this hour at 800-313-9443. And we're talking about Prozac. We've talked about how the process is of getting approval for, well, just about any drug. And keep in mind that all drugs have side effects, every single one of them. And as Dr. Daniels has mentioned, there's kind of a 50% ratio. Probably half the people that take these drugs are going to, well, have some, quite a lot of side effects, or even worse, including death. Alrighty, by 1984, Eli Lilly was well aware of the serious issues with Prozac, long before Lilly introduced it to the American market. Statistics in an internal Lilly document show that akathisia, a severe agitation that often provokes suicide, occurs in at least 1% of all patients. Now, keep in mind the huge number of people that are on this drug. 1% seems like kind of a minor little percentage point, but when you consider the vast number of people that take this drug, it can amount to, well, quite a few people. Lilly has a moral obligation to disclose that fact in its product literature and package inserts. Lilly lists akathisia in its product literature designed for the United States, but only as an infrequent event for Prozac users, and fails to mention akathisia and its relationship to suicide. Okay, let's, as I mentioned, we will take calls at 800-313-9443. And, whatever you want to talk about, but particularly about, well, psych drugs and drugs in general. Anyway, the internal documents those internal documents explain why the German regulators refused to approve Prozac without a stronger suicide warning more than 20 years ago. On May 25th, 1984, Barbara von Keitz, an Eli Lilly employee in Hamburg, sent a document to Lilly headquarters in Indianapolis regarding Prozac. Keitz, in referring to the fluoxetine studies conducted by Eli Lilly, stated that fluoxetine compared to standard antidepressants and placebo was ineffective. Keitz pointed out that there were 16 suicide attempts during the treatment with fluoxetine, two of which were successful. This was after Lilly excluded anyone who was at risk for suicide from the studies. Wow. Keitz suggested that the suicides could probably be attributed to the drug. Keitz pointed out that the number of patients was too small and many of the studies were incomplete as patients dropped out due to the high incidence of adverse side effects. On March 23, 1985, Dr. Richard Caput, K-A-P-I-T, after his safety review of fluoxetine, said in an internal FDA document that there were 76 significant adverse events occurring among patients exposed to fluoxetine in the clinical trials. He described some of the side effects, including hypersensitivity, psychotic episodes, and a decrease in hemoglobin level. Most frequently, this drug caused nausea, insomnia, nervousness, diarrhea, and a reduced appetite and weight loss. Depression often affects appetite, but fluoxetine intensifies anorexia and weight loss. Other adverse reactions experienced during the trials included seizures, paranoia, severe dystonic reaction, scaly rash, mania, suicide, attempted suicide, and movement disorders such as disconnected jaw movements, involuntary movements of the face and arms, vaginal bleeding, and allergic skin reactions requiring hospitalization. That is just amazing. That's just during the clinical trials. Let's see if there's any calls. Alrighty. Dr. Caput, the FDA psychiatrist in charge of evaluating the safety of Prozac, then writes, and I quote, "Unlike standard tricyclic antidepressants, fluoxetine's profile of adverse effects more closely resembles that of a stimulant drug than one that causes sedation and gain of weight." Unquote. Indeed, nervousness was the most common adverse symptom cited by the long-term fluoxetine patients who eventually discontinued therapy due to an adverse reaction. Unquote. Caput continued. He said, "It is possible that these adverse effects of fluoxetine treatment may negatively affect patients with depression." Unquote. He continued, "It may be appropriate to develop advisory labeling, warning the physician that certain signs and symptoms of depression may be exacerbated by this drug if the drug is marketed. Post-marketing studies should be required to determine the frequency with which fluoxetine may cause intensification of these specific signs and symptoms of depressive illness." Now, keep in mind, this is just me talking, keep in mind that most drugs do not have any post-marketing studies. Once a drug is out on the market, the FDA does not do any studies on it. They don't do any studies on the drugs at all. But they do not do any post-marketing surveys, nothing. The only way that a person can really indicate to the FDA that there is something wrong is that they can use the MedWatch system and complain or cite the fact that some that a drug that they have taken has caused an adverse reaction. However, most people do not know about this, and probably from 1 to 10%, usually closer to 1, even know that there is such a system where they can express their views or talk about the adverse reactions that they've had from drugs. So the FDA does not do any studies at all. Once it's out there, it's out there. And the only thing that the drug companies do is maybe send out a Dear Doctor letter in which they say, well, you might want to watch this. This isn't really scientific, but just kind of keep watch for these things. And doctors get these letters, and most of the real important information is at the bottom, which usually does not get read. Okay, back to the book. In the clinical trials, Prozac caused mania in 1 in 100 people, which would be much higher in unobserved patients in daily life. Because remember that during clinical trial, the people who participate in a clinical trial are observed. The people observe what they're eating, how they're feeling, what they're doing. So, 1 in 100, considered common, poses an incredible risk to public safety. The newer antidepressants, the SSRIs, are 4 times more likely to cause mania than the older antidepressants. Dr. Peter R. Bragan states, and I quote, 70% of the patients who become manic on Prozac had never shown any signs of manic tendencies in the past, unquote. On October 10th, 1985, the Psychopharmacologic Drugs Advisory Committee, the PDAC, convened a 2-day public hearing to determine the efficacy of Prozac on the first day and haloperidol on the second day. I know I butchered that word, but those are two of the drugs that they were talking about, and it was a 2-day public hearing. Anyway, according to the FDA, regarding its PDAC, and I quote, the committee shall consist of a core of 11 voting members, including the chair, selected by the commissioner from among authorities knowledgeable in the fields of psychopharmacology, psychiatry, epidemiology, and related specialties. The core of voting members may include one technically qualified member who is identified with consumer interest. In addition to the voting members, the committee may include one non-voting member who is identified with industry interest, unquote. The composition of the committee did not meet the FDA criteria in that there were 7 employees of Eli Lilly who participated. So out of 11 voting members, 7 of them worked for Eli Lilly. Now, that's really a huge conflict of interest. But the reason for this hearing was to determine the efficacy of Prozac. And, of course, if you're working for Eli Lilly, you are going to vote for the drug. The PDAC, deciding on Prozac and another drug, well, I'm not going to go through the names. Well, yes, I will, because some of them are very interesting. Okay. The PDAC, deciding on Prozac and another drug, consisted of Dr. Thomas Detry, Chairman, Dr. Frederick J. Abramek, Dr. Walter H. Carter, Dr. Sheldon H. Prescorn, Dr. Sandra Steinbach, Dr. Ching Pei Chine, Dr. Michael E. Stanley, Dr. Thomas Hayes, Dr. Karen Koop, Dr. Robert Temple, Dr. Paul Lieber, who is with the FDA, Dr. Linda Kessler, who is also with the FDA, Dr. J. Hillary Lee, Dr. George Chi, who is also with the FDA, and Dr. Richard Caput, who is also with the FDA. Those unassociated with the FDA were academics. And so, literally, you have people who work for the FDA, which is mostly funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Other participants, all seven of whom were employed by Eli Lilly, consisted of Dr. W. Lee Thompson, according to John Verrappen, was one of the top leading scientists employed by Eli Lilly. The other ones were Dr. Ray W. Fuller, Dr. Louis Limburger, Dr. Robert C. Zerbe, Dr. Joachim Wernicke, Dr. Guy Schaunard, and Dr. David Wong. Lilly knew Prozac's stimulating effects. Let me just check and see if there's any callers. We will take calls at 800-313-9443. You can talk about, well, psychiatry, the drug industry, whatever you'd like to talk about or ask or say. Okay. Lilly knew Prozac stimulating effects due to the clinical trials before the company marketed the drug. Charles M. Beasley, a Lilly executive, compiled a secret report, Activation and Sedation in Fluoxetine Clinical Studies. He totaled the number of patients who exhibited nervousness, anxiety, agitation, and insomnia. He discovered that 38% of them experienced these adverse effects during the brief clinical trials. He did not include hyperactivity, activity, euphoria, and mania. Lilly never revealed the results of Beasley's report to the FDA or any other entity. Lilly concealed the data until Dr. Peter R. Bragan discovered it in some company files when he was preparing materials for product liability suits against Eli Lilly. Many patients actually left the trials due to the drug's stimulating effect, leading to the Prozac trial's failure. Dr. Ray W. Fuller issued the following in-house secret order, and I quote, "Some patients have converted from severe depression to agitation within a few days of starting Prozac. In one case, the agitation was marked and the patient had to be taken off the drug. In future studies, the use of tranquilizers to control agitation will be permitted." Now, the FDA prohibits the use of tranquilizers in conjunction with Prozac in the clinical trials. The addictive tranquilizers, only to be taken for a brief period, masked Prozac's propensity to cause stimulation. In other words, the clinical trials, they cheated. Cheated big time. They stacked them with the right kind of people. And, I mean, well, the clinical trials were just stacked and numbered, just as I mentioned had happened with the clinical trials in Sweden, where they just jury-rigged all the numbers and got rid of all of the mention of death and suicide and all of the negative things that happened to the people who were participating in the clinical trials. Alrighty. Although Dr. J. Hillary Lee formerly worked for the FDA, she was still an FDA consultant and attended the meeting to present the efficacy of the antidepressant fluoxetine hydrochloride, the only drug that the group would discuss that day and one that the FDA had briefly reviewed. The next day, the doctors were scheduled to discuss the other drug. Dr. Lieber, in behalf of the FDA, concluded that fluoxetine was, and I quote, a reasonably safe antidepressant, but the FDA had not recommended that the FDA approve of the drug, as the agency was still waiting for evidence to be submitted regarding the dose-response relationship and the labeling of the product, a final safety update, and other matters that are yet to be determined. The FDA had issued guidelines on antidepressant drug products. Hang on, let me just check in the chat room, see if there's any questions or comments that... Okay, let's see. Back to this information on Prozac. The FDA had issued guidelines on antidepressant drug products in 1977 based on the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The FDA had accepted some of the studies submitted by the drug companies for the two drugs that the advisory committee would be discussing during that hearing. He reminded the group that, I'm talking about Lieber. Lieber reminded the group that in 1962, the law stated that the FDA should not approve of a drug if, and I quote, there is a lack of substantial evidence that the drug will have the effect it purports or is represented to have under the conditions of use prescribed, recommended, or suggested in the proposed labeling, unquote. He also mentioned the old efficacy, which is the need that the labeling of the drug should not be false or misleading in any particular. And if it is, then the FDA shouldn't approve it. Dr. Robert S. Mendelsohn wrote, and I quote, it doesn't make much sense to buy a drug when the manufacturer can't prove that it works. Now, the German drug regulators refused to license a drug when Lilly first applied in 1985, referring to the suicidal risk. Research in the late 1980s conducted by Eli Lilly confirmed that Prozac may cause suicide, yet many doctors prescribed it to their patients supposedly to prevent depression and suicide. Lilly evaluated its clinical trials, which they claim involved more than 3,000 patients. They published their results in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, alleging that there was no increased suicide risk. Yet, even within the article, it states that there were 6 suicides out of 1,765 patients on Prozac, as opposed to 1 in the 569 patients on placebo. The general public typically does not read medical journals. They're never going to look at any of this stuff. They're never going to look at the numbers. Now, in 1986, in the clinical trials, 12.5 patients out of 1,000 who were taking Prozac committed suicide, as compared to only 3.8 patients who were taking the non-SSRI antidepressants and 2.5 patients who were taking a placebo. In 1995, in another trial for Prozac, the suicide rate would be 6 times higher. Package inserts mention suicide, but not all the other possible adverse reactions. Suicide was not on the insert for years, even though Eli Lilly knew of the risk. On November 13, 1990, Claude Bucci and Hans Weber, two employees of Lilly in Germany, sent a memo to the drug epidemiology unit at the Eli Lilly headquarters, as they were concerned about Lilly asking them to report that patient suicide attempts were accidental overdoses and that they were to record suicidal ideation as depression. In other words, headquarters told them to fake it, to call it accidental, to record suicidal ideation as mere depression. Bucci shared this memo with the author, Joseph Glenn Mullen. Eventually, the FDA found out about Eli Lilly's deadly deceptions. Because the company had spent millions of dollars, it would be a financial catastrophe if the FDA failed to approve of Prozac, which was ineffective without the use of a tranquilizer. The FDA, to rescue Eli Lilly, included those trials where the patients used tranquilizers and manipulated the statistical data regarding the drug's effectiveness, and Prozac squeaked through. Though the FDA approved of Prozac when used with addictive tranquilizers, no one informed the medical profession, the unsuspecting potential patients, or the public. So the FDA lies to the public, the pharmaceutical industry lies to the public. Now, incredibly, the FDA approved of Prozac using only 3 cherry-picked favorable protocols involving 17 studies and several hundred patients. Dr. Bragan thoroughly examined each of the 17 studies to determine exactly how many Prozac patients actually finished the 4, 5, or 6 week trials. The total number of patients was a paltry 286 patients. Out of the thousands who initially offered to participate in the clinical trials, less than 300 patients completed the trials. Based on the conclusions of the predisposed questions of the doctors monitoring those patients, the FDA approved Prozac on December 29, 1987 for treating depression. The FDA provided its summary of basis of approval of Prozac on October 3, 1988, using the 14 protocols involving Lilly's submitted controlled studies. Anyone taking Prozac for more than a few weeks is actually participating in a continuous clinical trial due to the failure of the FDA to require legitimate, reasonably timed trials that actually test long-term usage, effectiveness, and safety. No wonder the Germans thought the number of patients completing the trials was too small. In January 1988, the month that Eli Lilly introduced Prozac, people reported events describing fluoxetine-induced violence against self and others. In May 1990, the FDA mandated that Eli Lilly add suicidal ideation and violent behaviors to the post-introduction reports section of its label. Antidepressants and other psychiatric drugs can contribute to marital conflicts, manic-like thoughts, paranoia, violent impulses, and abnormal, irrational, bizarre, and destructive behavior. All antidepressants, including the SSRIs, can cause mania. It has been fully documented that Prozac can cause mania in patients who have previously never experienced or had any tendencies toward mania. According to the APA's DSM-4, which was published in 1994, the American Psychiatric Association, and the DSM is the is literally the Bible. Anyway, it says, symptoms, and I quote, symptoms like those seen in a manic episode may also be precipitated by antidepressant treatment such as medication, unquote. The DSM clarifies that mania is frequently associated with violence and other criminal acts. The psychotic behavior can be goal-directed. It states that patients often display irritability, particularly when the person's wishes are thwarted. By 1994, the FDA revealed that out of the 54 million people worldwide who took Prozac, it had received 30,000 adverse event reports, including more than 1,700 deaths. Out of those deaths, 1,100 committed suicide, while another 1,900 attempted suicide. Almost 10% of the total adverse effects, the ADAs, from those taking Prozac were suicide and suicide attempts. In spite of those 30,000 reports, the FDA did not demand black box warnings on Prozac or other antidepressants for 13 years. the FDA has repeatedly failed to withdraw the SSRIs after hundreds of adverse effects and suicides. In 1998, the FDA commissioned a survey that discovered that doctors had prescribed Prozac for infants 3,000 times. Okay, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
My neighbor, welcome again to this neighborhood. I'd like to show you something. You know what this is? Maybe if I press this button.
There are so many things.
All righty, this is Deanna, and I'm subbing for Clint. Right here on the Corporation Nation here on RBN. Clint's websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. All righty, we do have some callers. Let's take Jeff in Idaho. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna. Hey, thanks for all the time that you spent on air doing all this stuff. You know, I wanted to send you a note, and the book one and book two that I stole off the presses before you got to them, you know, I was going to mail them to you and, attach the information, but since you showed up on the air, all the SSR stuff you're doing is, I'm working with Dr. Parker right now on trying to get Dr. Clark, like, testing done instead of the fake double-blind study stuff that has no relevance and are falsified and all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
And over the past year, I've been kind of calling in every week to basically apply like some of the stuff we were doing since 2010, critical thinking, you know, and get people aware of what's going on. So when you basically were talking with Michael Collins Piper, and you know, I said, hey, I'm going to help anyone on RBN, so I kind of helped you a little bit, and then I had the death panel thing come up with my mom that I had to, you know, solve for a couple years, and I kind of got that resolved. But I transferred all the technology to Dr. Parker on what I'd done, and he had basically used MIT to basically use Tesla waves to create hemocyanin type hemoglobin. So all this work that we've done has not been in vain, even with her passing away. But you know,
I'm sorry to hear that.
I included your segment with Helen Thomas on that you know, she really liked.
Yes.
But,
yes.
But
I'm sorry, Jeff.
Yeah.
I know it's been hard.
So what I'm doing is I'm working with Clint and Patrick on all the stuff too, on all the stuff I did design wise. Works with Tesla shockwaves to epigenetic reset what they're messing up with medicines.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And all the chemtrailing they're doing, you know, to reset the genome.
Right.
I've been working with Dr. Parker now. My whole stumbling block is Dr. Parker has to stay alive for this technology to be transferred. And so you know, I'm always kind of out there. I'll be starting from page 113 on book one, you know, from the editing stuff we did a long time ago. You know, here in a couple months. But you know, you keep going on whatever you're doing because you're fabulous.
Oh well, thank
you. Don't give up on all your stuff.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
And bless you. Bye, bye, Jeff. All righty, let's take Joe in Missouri.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Doing good. Thanks for taking my call, although I just was going to throw a couple things out there, but Jeff seems to have some pretty heavy-duty things going on, so, I mean, I don't know if he wanted to expand on that a little bit, but that's... he's talking about Tesla waves and vibrational energy and kind of Rife-type science things, I suspect, at the end of the day, which I'm totally all... or open and knowledgeable, well, or I know of the existence of these things, and I'm open to the idea that vibration, obviously, and frequency is a very, very important component to just about anything you want to, any subject you want to bring up. But having said all that, really what I was going to call in to talk about, it's been a little while. Well, I want to thank you, number one, for guest. It sounds like you kind of got thrown into this. I hope Clint's doing okay.
Oh, no,
but,
no. Clint, I don't know exactly why he asked me to sub, but I think that many times his mom comes from Sacramento. And so, no, I just think of it as an opportunity, and Clint is a good friend. And so, yeah, I'm very happy to
sub. Thank you for doing it. Always enjoy your material, and kind of repeating a little bit of the, I think the last time we talked when you were also guest hosting, but about how, you know, how is everyone putting up with the FDA? I mean, it's really kind of ridiculous. These guys, it's just so blatantly in-house, and, you know, there's nothing they're doing to protect anyone, quite the opposite. And the last, I wouldn't expect you to remember this, but last time we talked, you were talking about big pharma, but we also got into big farming. Mm-hmm. I brought up Monsanto, and somehow all these things come under the roof of the FDA. And I was pointing out there was a guy at some point who was appointed the head of the FDA who had previously been one of the top attorneys for Monsanto. I mean, this kind of
Well, it's a revolving door between the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA, and the FDA is really largely funded by the pharmaceutical industry. When they started producing more and more drugs, then they literally staffed the FDA with extra people that they were, mm-hmm. in fact, paying for. And so, you know, you mentioned that there are so many people. Why do people put up with this? Well, most people believe that the FDA would never approve of anything that wasn't good. And so they are under the impression that the FDA has our best interest at heart. And that is just not true. The FDA is an agency that is totally devoted to protecting the butts of the pharmaceutical industry, and that's what they do.
Well, and there seems to be a reoccurring theme, just like the whole Monsanto thing, and now that I think through it a little further, I don't think Monsanto is exactly food. I think they're chemical. Originally,
oh, yeah.
They were a chemical weapons defense contractor in the 60s. I mean, they did Agent Orange and all this. So if you think about it, they're more like chemistry, which is pretty close to pharmaceuticals anyways.
Right.
So my only point being, people aren't paying attention. Obviously, if you've got an ex-high-level attorney of Monsanto, then sitting on the top, you know, being overseeing the FDA, it's such a blatant conflict of interest that how could anyone sit there and go, yeah, they're protecting us or whatever. So, I mean, they're just mm-hmm. not paying attention, and maybe that's purposeful or denial, or maybe people just, a lot of people just obviously don't pay attention to anything. But I think what I really wanted to, so that seems obvious to me anyways, mm-hmm. is that the FDA is just, it's ridiculous. And what I was going to try and spit out is Monsanto does the same thing that these pharmaceutical companies do. They do their own in-house testing.
Mm-hmm.
They do their own environmental impact studies, which aren't the real ones, which would take a, you know, a control group and 20 years to really do it right and all this. They don't do that. They do it in-house, and they just say, oh, yeah, we looked into it, and everything's fine. I mean, again, blatant conflict of interest. I don't see how anybody with a pretty basic understanding of just simple stuff couldn't see that. But
exactly. Well, the FDA does no testing whatsoever. The companies do all their own testing, and then they submit the clinical trials to the FDA for approval. And, of course, they're submitting them to people that they know or people who have previously worked in the psychiatric or the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, you made mention of the fact that that Agent Orange was produced, well, it was produced by Monsanto and a few other companies. But you also keep in mind that mustard gas later became what the medical industry used for chemotherapy.
Yeah, I think that's
World
what
War
I was kind of mm-hmm. realizing is that it's all the same. It's just the chemical people. They don't, you know.
Sure.
It could be Agent Orange or it could be mustard gas therapy. It's all just chemicals. Some of them will kill. Some of them will help. I mean, at least it's almost like they just have to put the marketing spin on it. It's like this
sure.
very same chemical will kill and or help and or.
Yeah. I don't know that it would help anything. I think all of them tend to kill. And keep in mind also that Standard Oil or the Rockefeller plan was really behind the getting rid of all the competition in the medical industry. They got rid of all of the naturopathic hospitals and anything that any school that didn't teach the cut, burn, poison method was pretty much eliminated and was no longer approved of by the American Medical Association, which is another agency that strictly protects doctors rather than patients.
Yeah, and you know what? I'd like to give a shout-out to Gary. A lot of times I'm bad with his back last name, but Gary that did the T-shirt with the guns don't kill.
Oh, yes, Gary V. He's so terrific, yeah.
I love Gary, and I had a great time meeting him, and I just think what he's on about is just great. But that's exactly what I really wanted to get to and get your opinion on is, I know we talk a lot about how these guys are just making, and they really are, sick amounts of profit, like the most profitable industries on the planet. So that's nothing to be dismissed or taken lightly. But on the other hand, it seems sometimes to me like, I mean, these guys can have money all day long. There's something even deeper about keeping people sick. Also, in the case of this stuff, just like Gary's T-shirt or your slogan, it's as if they want to create people that can become these, you know, individual shooters and stuff, just to kind of, I don't know, promote
chaos, strange, to
almost justify that kind of stuff. When in reality, maybe behind the scenes, it's really not just someone who kind of came up, cooked up these ideas on their own, and then went in and did this thing. It's a little more orchestrated,
and then
get them on these things, and then, yeah, let them be involved. I don't know. I mean, I'm just kind of, obviously, we're moving into some great speculation, but the profit alone doesn't seem... It seems like an outer layer. There seems to be something deeper even about creating, you know, folks that are suicidal, homicidal. I don't know, but...
Well, it's a lot of profit. It's a profit-producing industry that starts when a child... From the time a person is born, they are injected with chemicals the minute they're born. And they want to keep everybody drugged up, doped up. Everybody needs to be, according to the pharmaceutical industry, they want everyone taking something. So they cook up all of these standards like heart, blood pressure standards and cholesterol standards, where in fact, those are just made up diseases, made up problems. The psychiatric, categories, those are created by the industry. Psychiatrists, they sit around and decide, well, what can we think of as a disease? APA actually had an announcement on their website saying, if you can, you can mail in or email a mental disease to see if we would be interested in including it in our upcoming DSM. In other words, they sit around and create these psychiatric mental conditions, like sad. If you're too sad,
the ones that shy, are voted on, right.
They vote on
the DSB or the DSM.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. So it's the only industry where they actually create their own profit margin, their own profit structure. They create sick people. The doctors can never use the word cure. They treat you. They never cure you. Okay, you go to the doctor to be treated. And it's 90% of the people who go to a doctor walk out with a prescription.
I think I don't want to repeat myself because it's like I suddenly wanted to say something, but it's like, yeah, didn't you say that the last time you were talking to Deanna? But, it's as if they have to come up, and they do with this insurance folks, these actuarial tables where they have to figure out just, can we keep them alive 60 years? But then that's 60 years of they're on this, you know, everyday pill, which costs a lot of money. You know,
right.
So keep them alive long enough to make some pretty good profit, but you know, whatever. And I don't know, that's a darker side, but same thing as I was talking about before. I know it's darker speculation, but it seems like profit may not be the only thing, even though that's
depopulation.
More than enough.
It's depopulation.
It's the biggest profit on the planet, but.
Sure. If you don't kill them in a war, then you can kill them when they get back, or kill them before they go. It's all depopulation.
I guess that's really what I was kind of leading up to, and not
sure.
Just depopulation, but kind of fear-based stuff. If you can have someone kind of freak out and shoot people and then themselves or something, you know, that's very unsettling. And I wonder to what extent there's a little bit of if you're into Jan Ervin's stuff and how he talks about Dave McGowan, and Dave McGowan wrote a book called Programmed to Kill, and he found out that just much like a lot of these entertainment people that have all these connections to military intelligence,
sure,
a lot of these famous individual killers have had strange connections to military intelligence or just flat out military, and in many cases, of course, they end up getting on some kind of antidepressants.
True.
You know, the classic
I've interviewed Dave McGowan several times. I understand he's really ill right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that.
He's got lung cancer.
Oh, no. Well, maybe Jeff, who was talking about stuff before, is that what his name, the gentleman's name from Idaho?
Yes,
If I were Dave, I'd be looking into everything alternative right now.
Yeah. We should all look for alternative methods for a lot of stuff. But anyway.
I'll tell you what, for the lungs, if it were Dave, I might be thinking about some of this, high-powered hemp oil that's really, you know, the real deal, and then vaporizing it. But that's a whole other subject. But
like Rick Simpson.
Yeah, except there's newer stuff. Rick Simpson, not to bore you, this is kind of sideline, but was using butanes and some things in the process, and there are actual clean ways to do all that. I have been told or read. I'll make that disclaimer right now.
Sure.
But there are ways to do that process and still get the end result where you're using natural methods as opposed to much more chemical, which is, you know, apropos for the discussion we're having. The less chemicals, the better life is. But, something like that in a vaporizer, that's what I would be recommending for Dave. But, anyways, that's a sideline. I'm very sorry to hear about that because I've been taken by his work. He just kind of leaves it where he leaves it, which is, ain't this interesting? But Jan is really on to more of a, well, yeah, it's not just interesting. These aren't just piled up coincidences.
They're
really going somewhere very strong.
Sure.
And that's what I was kind of trying to just get your thoughts on that, because that's what seems to be going on with a lot of this stuff to me. Like, it's a very controlled, designed thing from the top on down.
Of course. Well, we're going to a break. Joe, thanks for calling in. Appreciate it.
It is like pointing away to the moon. Don't concentrate on the finger or you will miss all that heavenly glory.
Empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless.
All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and it's been my pleasure to sub for Clint tonight, and that's Clint Richardson of Corporation Nation. His websites are realityblogger.wordpress.com and thecorporationnation.com. And our caller was talking about, depopulation. Joe was talking about it seemed like it was very deliberate. And I think when you consider that Bill Gates was talking about using vaccine for decreasing the world's population, I think it's very deliberate. And then we have to also think about Henry Kissinger's NSSM 200, which is the National Security Study Memorandum 200, and it is readily available. It came out in 1974, and it was concealed were classified until relatively recently, maybe 1998. There's details about exactly how they wanted to decrease the population. And please look that up and check that out. Now, getting back to the idea of Prozac and to the SSRI drugs, I lastly mentioned that in 1998, the FDA commissioned a survey that discovered that doctors had prescribed Prozac for infants 3,000 times. Now, keep in mind that Prozac was never tested on infants, and that somehow 3,000 doctors just arbitrarily, off-label, decided to prescribe this horrific, suicide-producing drug for infants. Ah, that's criminal. That's absolutely criminal. Now, in 1985, American sales of antidepressants and antipsychotics had totaled $503 million. In 1987, Eli Lilly had $2.3 billion in its pharmaceutical division. In January 1988, Eli Lilly began selling Prozac. By 1992, it was the company's first billion-dollar drug. By 1998, Zyprexa was Eli Lilly's second billion-dollar drug. By 2000, Eli Lilly was bringing in revenues of $10.8 billion just on those two drugs. In 2008, the sales of antidepressants and antipsychotics would total $24.2 billion, almost 50 times greater. Antipsychotics even outsold cholesterol-lowering medications. Worldwide sales of all psychotropic drugs reached $40 billion. In 1999, Prozac produced one quarter of the company's $10 billion in revenue. So, that was their blockbuster drug. And it's just amazing how many people take this drug. They take it not knowing, not understanding how dangerous it is. And yet they figure, well, if the FDA approved it and my doctor wrote a prescription for it, then it must be fine. And people who had never, ever considered being hostile, being homicidal, being suicidal, then became suicidal, homicidal. Well, thank you so much for joining me tonight, and take care. Thank you.